ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If you woke up tomorrow and found yourself Prime Minister, what would you do? How would you run Australia? What's your plan for energy, for housing, for the economy? The Economy Stupid has a three-part series talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it where you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Collaboration is becoming something of a buzzword, synonymous perhaps with innovation, with creative sparks, with exciting possibilities, problems solved, all that sort of stuff. But historically, it's meant something darker. In Nazi Germany, for example, or Mao's China, or during the Reformation. So what happens when this act of thinking together devolves and collaboration becomes about conformity, complicity, or collusion? Hey, it's Natasha Mitchell here with Big Ideas. Welcome to you. Today, the dark side of collaboration.
I would like to have a dollar for every time I've gone into an organisation or an institution where there's been ethical failure. And even to this day, I can tell you that there are many, many places where you will walk in the door and ask people to explain to you why they are doing what they are doing, and you will still today get no better explanation than it's just what we do, or everybody does it. That's how the insurance industry works, or banking, or sport. Everybody does it, and so on and so forth.
We each have an internal moral compass, don't we, that helps us differentiate right from wrong. But a quick scan of news headlines suggests that many struggle to, or don't care to, or are hell-bent on confusing the two, perhaps. Philosopher Dr. Simon Longstaff is longtime director of the Ethics Centre. He's worked with countless organisations to really foster ethical standards in governance, in policy, in business. And we are joining Simon today at the Bundanon Art Museum on Dharawal and Derga country on the south coast of New South Wales.
Well, thank you, Sophie, and thanks for coming along for this conversation. I decided, in fact, just this morning to try and find out how many books and articles might have been published with the word collaboration in the title. So what did I do? I went to ChatGPT and asked it to tell me the answer, and it came back, too many. It can't count them. There are just so many about that. And so there's clearly a very light side to collaboration, and we've already heard from Sophie speaking about some of the impact that collaboration can have for artists with the natural world, with each other, and how this can be something to be celebrated. But like most ideas, they can have a positive and a negative aspect. And so today I want to unpack what might be called the darker side of collaboration, and to understand what might flow from that in terms of our own lives and how we might think critically even about the concept and when it applies. So on the 25th of August in 1944, in the City of Light, there was a moment of liberation. On that day, after 10 days of fighting initiated by the French resistance, the German forces, led by a General Dietrich von Choltitz, against all of the orders of Adolf Hitler, who had insisted that Paris not be surrendered but instead be destroyed prior to any movement of German forces away from that city. Instead, von Choltitz, disobeying those orders from Hitler, actually presented himself at the Hotel de Ville and surrendered to General Leclerc, who had led the French 2nd Armoured Division. Resistance had started, but the French forces, the Allied forces, had been in support, and overnight they had rolled in and taken possession of the city, which brought about that moment of surrender. Of course, this was a matter of huge celebration for the French and for the Allies. Symbolically returning to France saw de Gaulle the next day installed as a head of the provisional government. Starting at the Arc de Triomphe, as you might imagine, there was a parade with the 2nd Division going through the streets of Paris. There were wild celebrations. And yet, at the same time as that was happening, another series of events started to unfold. Those events were known as the épurgation sauvage, that is, the wild purge. And effectively, it involved rounding up people who were seen to have been collaborators with the occupying forces of Nazi Germany. A particular group were targeted. Here's one of the women, her head covered in blood, having had her hair shorn off, being paraded in shame. Now, undoubtedly, there was a deep felt sense of resentment directed at anyone who had collaborated, or particularly what they called horizontal collaboration, women who were thought to have slept with the Germans. And yet there were around 20,000 of these women, on current estimates, perhaps more, who were subjected to this treatment. I want you to look just for a moment, just to stare, I'm not going to dwell on these images, not just at the women, but at the faces of the men, and they are largely men who are engaged in this. There doesn't seem to be any sense of compassion or a sense of seriousness. They are smiling, they are leering. So the question becomes, and I'll go some more into this in a moment, who are we supposed to be focusing on in this photograph? Are we focusing on the collaborator, in inverted commas, or are we equally to focus on the group that are sharing their heads and parading them in the streets? And what's happening to them at this moment? What are they collaborating in at that moment of what they would claim to be justice? Of course, the Nazi regime was an appalling one. We know the extremes of evil that they were capable of and how they visited upon people, notably those who ended up in concentration camps and things like that. And the concept of collaborating with the Nazis took on a very sharp turn for anybody who was living through those years. There were people like Vidkun Quisling, who for a period of time was ruling Norway, whose name today still stands for those who collaborate with evil. If you talk about a person being a Quisling, then you are invoking his name. And he was subsequently executed by firing squad in Norway for the crimes of treason and others that he'd committed. But then there are more complicated questions of people who are thought to have been involved in and collaborating with the Nazis. The Sonderkommando, people who were within places like Auschwitz and Belsen, who were brought into a position where they were forced to be part of the machinery of killing. Now, they would say, I am sure, that given any kind of choice, they would have preferred not to have been doing what they were doing. And history, generally speaking, would say there is no culpability for those in those circumstances. But what of a woman, perhaps a single mother, who's been widowed on the front, who is looking to actually simply find a way to have a meal? What of the person who, in the extraordinary fluid circumstances of war, falls in love with someone, even though they wear the uniform of an enemy? What of the woman, and this is one of the cases that's recorded, who merely stood at a window? She used to manufacture funeral wreaths, and a German soldier stopped by her window and spoke to her for about 15 minutes. That was the extent of her collaboration. And yet her door was broken down. She was stripped. She had her hair shorn and she was paraded in the streets to be shamed. And what of the person who did none of those things, but who had annoyed a neighbour or some other person and subsequently became named as the Quisling, as the collaborator? In fact, what we have seen throughout history is that often people are either complicit in some form of wrongdoing or are alleged to have been complicit according to most variable standards. We know, for example, of the people held in Lubyanka during Stalin's purges, often nominated to as a kind of Quisling or traitor or collaborator simply because they didn't fall on the right side of some political faction or because someone desired to have their apartment or whatever. We know what happened during the Cultural Revolution with Mao's purges. Then we also know what happened in the supposed liberal democracy of the United States of America when Eugene McCarthy's House for Un-American Activities was let loose on people. And all sorts of people were brought before and were attempted to be and were in fact shamed and excluded because they were perceived to have collaborated or associated with someone who held a point of view, a political position, or participated in a form of life which was inconsistent with what the dominant majority thought to be appropriate. So the issue of collaboration isn't something on its darker side that we need to restrict to an understanding of how particular individuals might actually make a mistake or make a conscious decision to enjoin with someone else who ought to be opposed. It can also be something which touches us as a crowd, as a group, as a whole society. So I want to talk a little bit about the influences that might lead a person to find themselves on the wrong side of collaboration, if I can put it in those terms, whether as individuals or as a group, because there are some features in common and some particular causes which are worth being mindful of. Over the past 33 years that I've been engaged in the work which I do today, I've actually encountered many, many people who have been engaged in or have been complicit with some form of wrongdoing. Not to the scale of engaging with Nazis or things, but perhaps in ways that nonetheless still have an adverse impact on the lives of other people. People in banking and financial services, for example, who may have been on the ground floor in events that gave rise to what was called the global financial crisis in Australia. Or people who ended up before something like the Royal Commission that Kenneth Hayne ran, looking at cases where someone appeared to give evidence and had to hear themselves say out loud that, yes, it was true that they'd been involved in charging fees to dead people. Or it might have been cricketers who'd been tampering with a cricket ball and had caused all sorts of scandal. Or it could have been people involved in defence or national security or a whole range of activities. And when I've met with these people, often very soon after the events have occurred, and have asked them to explain to me what happened, invariably there is a common theme in their response. What they say, without guile, without any intention to deceive me, but with absolute sense of the truth of what they're going to claim, is that at the time, they just didn't see it. I just didn't see it, they say. They maybe now look back, maybe it's a year or so later, oh yes, I can see this thing now, but at the time I didn't see it. And it's one of the great questions that philosophers have wondered about from the time of Aristotle, who is particularly interested in what we see and what we don't see and how our vision of the world is distorted. And I'll touch a little bit more on that later. But it's one of the great questions that philosophers, particularly in the area of ethics, have wondered about is, what is it that allows us to see the true nature of the thing we do or to be making mistakes based on an error of perception? How is it that we don't see things? Well, one account that is often provided about how we find ourselves on the wrong side of a decision is that we're prone to something called willful blindness. That is, we can see what the right thing is to do, and despite knowing it with quite good clarity, nonetheless we act in a different manner. I suppose the closest example I can think of this is if any of you were driving down here in a speed zone which was, say, 100 kilometres an hour, and you allowed yourself to edge to 102 or 103, making a calculation that a speed camera probably allows for a certain degree of divergence from the nominated speed. If ever that's happened to you, and of course it's never happened to me, then you would know that you absolutely have clarity about what the speed limit is. It's there, it's 100, it probably says so on your dashboard these days, and you know that you're doing it 103. You know you're exceeding what is the nominated speed limit, but you're making a calculation that this is not such an egregious fault that anyone's going to pull you over and there won't be any penalty, but you actually can see it. And there are many cases where people actually ascribe to those who collaborate or collude with wrongdoing, that they must see what they're doing, they must have known, and that they actually are lying to you when they say, I just didn't see it, because they're being willfully blind, looking away for the wrongdoing that they can see for what it is. In fact, what I have found is that in most cases, this is not true. In most cases, when people do the wrong thing, and invariably they are essentially good people who make bad decisions, it's not with a clear sense that what they're going to do is wrong, that they're colluding or collaborating with something which is wrong. Instead, they're subject to a different phenomenon, a kind of conditioned blindness, which changes their ability to perceive the world as it actually is.
Philosopher Dr. Simon Longstaff is our big thinker today on Big Ideas here on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app. My name is Natasha Mitchell and we are exploring the ethics of wrongdoing and its many collaborators. We heard there from Simon about the idea of conditioned blindness. So whether they're bystanders or participants, how do good people justify their role in bad acts?
Now, there are a few ways in which we can allow ourselves to become deceived by what is actually there in terms of our ethical judgment. I'll give you four types of things that are a form of self-deception, which emerged from a very interesting paper I read years ago by a fellow called John Knapp. The first of these, and in fact all of these, starts with something which is perfectly good, something that we should celebrate and understand, but taken to an extreme. A point I'll come back to later, it takes on a quite different character. So the first is called legalism. The idea that if it's not illegal, it's not wrong. Now, you've probably all heard through your life, at one time or another, somebody make that claim. Well, if it's not illegal, it's not wrong. Just tell me what the rule is. Show me the code. Show me the legislation. And it starts with a perfectly reasonable and good thing, the law. Something collectively we bring to bear to try and regulate the affairs amongst us. It has a tremendous effect. We have all sorts of principles which we adhere to at our best, where the law is something which enables a good society to flourish. But this idea that the law encapsulates every aspect of judgment and that you should not and need not look any further than the law risks becoming something very pernicious. Because the thing about the law is that it is contingent. That is, there is nothing necessary about its form. I mean, some people in the area of natural law might want to argue differently about this, but most of the laws, most of the rules we operate could be different but for a judgment that was made at a particular point in time. And in fact, even in Australia, there have been unjust laws. Laws, for example, against miscegenation, and where it was a crime for a white person, a white man typically, to cohabit with a black woman in the state of Victoria for many years, pretty much identical to the kind of anti-miscegenation laws that existed in apartheid South Africa. If somebody had said, or said to us today, oh, well, there's nothing to look at there, it's not wrong what they're seeking to restrict simply because that's the law, most of us, I think, today would be outraged by that claim. And so the first kind of blindness that you can be subjected to is to say, well, the law allows it, or a rule not only allows it, may even require it, that can stop you looking. You just stop at that point. The second kind of blindness comes from tribalism, a sense of belonging. Again, it starts with something good. Humans are social beings. We should do things together where we can. It's probably very much behind the idea about the virtue of collaboration rather than some of its vicious aspects. But there are points at time when you are in a group, particularly a group under pressure, where you no longer see the wider world, where the only thing that matters is what that group is thinking about, what it feels, what it judges to be right or wrong. And this is a particularly strong feature of the world in which we are living at the moment, which I will return to later when I try and assess our current position. Because it's very easy to take something good like belonging and to have it become such a blanket of conformity that you never look outside the bonds of that group. And as I say, there's a particular danger in this at the moment. The third issue that can make us not see is a kind of role relativism, where we actually don't see ourselves as acting in the world as whole people. I still recall attending a lunch years and years ago now, which included a very prominent business leader from Australia who was also quite openly a committed Christian. This individual spent a lot of the lunch time telling me about the nature of his faith, the way it was enacted in his day-to-day life. But then, without any prompting from me, he began to tell me the story about what used to take place between Monday and Friday in his business life. And he told me a story, which I'm making it more lurid than it probably was, but it basically sounded like between Monday and Friday he engaged in the equivalent of corporate rape and pillage. And so I was brought up short. And I said, I can't understand this. I said, look, you've just told me about these beliefs you hold and how they inform your life. How is it possible that you do these things that you've just described? And he turned to me and he said, but it's not me. It's just my job. In other words, a kind of violence had been done to the self in which who you were was cut off from what you did. And you said, oh, well, it's my job. Now, again, I'm not saying this is a bad starting point. I think we should all take account of the nature of the roles we're given, what we agree to do. But to the point that it makes you blind, where the fact that it's written or prescribed, to go back to the Second World War, the Nuremberg defence, I was just following orders, is of a version of this kind. That was my job, but it wasn't really me. It can make you not truly see the nature of the way that you're acting in the world. And the final kind of blindness that we can all be subject to is a kind of deference to authority. Now, when Knapp was writing about this, he was thinking about a particular experiment called the Milgram experiment, which had been conducted in the United States. In this experiment, a group of students were brought into a laboratory situation, and they were told that their task was to push a button to administer an electric shock to a person on the other side of a glass screen. And the two controls they had was one, the button to administer the electric shock, and the second was a dial which could either increase or decrease the size of that shock. And so they would push the button, and there'd be when the dial was down low, there'd be kind of a reaction from the person on the other side. And the further they turned up the dial, the more violent the reaction. And in fact, they'd been given a little electric shock at the beginning just to get a taste of what it was like at its lowest level. What they didn't know was that on the other side of the glass wall was an actor who was performing the role of what it's like to be given an electric shock. What they could see, that is what the actor could see, was when the button was pressed, and they could see where the dial had been turned in order to mediate their performance to suit the size of the charge. And the test was nothing to do with the actor. It was about the extent to which the students would accede to authority. Because when they were told that this was in the name of science, as opposed to just do this, then up and up went the reading. It was a significant material difference. In other words, they didn't have to stop and think for themselves. They didn't have to look. What instead happened was that they, over time, typically deferred to the authority of science. Now, we do this increasingly where there is an authority. Again, it might start with something good. I take it on good authority that there is a dark side of the moon. I've never been there. I take it on good authority that such things as blue whales exist. I've never seen one. But if I am going to be asked to electrocute another person or to participate in other things which ostensibly seem to be wrong, I hope I'm not simply going to give way and do this because of the authority of the person who tells me, because of their claimed expertise or their status in a hierarchy or something of that kind. These four things, of course, can act together concurrently. It's possible to have all four acting upon you, which is deadening your sense of the reality of what you're doing. And they can also be exacerbated by other forms of blindness that might come about because of cognitive biases of one kind or another. But taken together, they can make us not see. Because if we become enculturated into this way of deferring to authority or the preferences of the group or what the role requires or thinking that all that matters is the law, then over time we become conditioned not to see. The conditioning of what we see in the world is a potent force. So let me give you an example. From the time we are born, when we open our eyes for the first time, one of the things we are enabled to do as humans is to recognise a face, the face of our parents, of our family, our friends. We become brilliant at telling whether the face is of a friend or a foe. We are so conditioned to see human faces that we see them even where they do not exist. We see them in clouds. We see them on stains on a wall or something like that. And equally troubling is that we can be conditioned not to see things that are there. There are cases, for example, of vivisectors who worked on effectively torturing chimps and other animals, monkeys, who over time have given us the testimony of how they were conditioned not to see it as a screaming monkey, but as a research subject engaging in avoidance behaviour while receiving negative reinforcement. Just think how different that language is. A screaming monkey there before you, or a research subject engaging in avoidance behaviour while receiving negative reinforcement. So when people say to you, well, I just didn't see it, it's not just some kind of claim that's being made to get off the hook. It may be that they are telling you the truth about the nature of their own conditioning. Now, this can have major effects. I want to take you to a book written by the great American historian, no longer with us, called Barbara Tuchman, called The March of Folly. Barbara Tuchman is trying to understand in The March of Folly how it is that human beings make calamitously bad decisions. And she gives four cases that she forensically examines using the historical record. The first is the decision by the Trojans to bring in the Greek horse, which leads to the destruction of their city. The second is the decision by the Catholic Church under people like Alexander VI and others who'd corrupted it at the core to completely ignore the complaints of Martin Luther when he nailed his theses on the cathedral door at Wittenberg. The third case she examines is the way in which the British failed to pay heed to the claims of their North American colonists that if they were to be taxed, they should be represented, they should enjoy the full rights of Englishmen as British subjects. And the fourth case she looks at is how the descendants of those American colonists, having formed their own country and becoming a military superpower, nonetheless suffered defeat when in Vietnam, despite all of their weapons, their material, their personnel. And she says, as I look at these four cases, the important thing is that they each need to satisfy three conditions. The first condition that they satisfy is that at the time they made the decision, for example, to bring in the horse, they knew that this was a really serious decision that they were making, that it was potentially dangerous. The second thing that is in place, the second condition they satisfy, is that at the time they made the decision, there was a better alternative available. They didn't have to do the one thing that they did. And the third condition was that there were people there on the ground at the time saying, don't do it. This is dangerous. There are better alternatives. And yet, despite in all four cases, these conditions being satisfied, the Trojans did lift the lintel from the gate and they brought in Odysseus and the horse. The Catholic Church paid no heed to Luther, and their hegemony in Europe was broken, and decades of bloody warfare and torture unfolded until the Treaty of Westphalia basically sorted it out. Despite that, the British lost the majority of their North American colonies in a failed war. And finally, the Americans lose in Vietnam, not because they lack the material, but because they lose moral authority. They conduct the war in a way that even the people at home cannot justify the legitimacy of it continuing. And to this day, if you look at the US Marine Corps and Army manual on counterinsurgency, the chapter on ethics has the heading that says, lose moral authority, lose the war. So how does this happen? Barbara Tuchman says, how is it possible that these really bad decisions are made? And she tries a couple of ideas, not just thinking about them in abstract terms, but actually fitting them against the historical record. She says, oh, well, one possibility, and hence the title of the book, is that we are just foolish creatures. Human beings are just simply condemned to acts of folly where we either will not, or more chillingly so, cannot learn the lessons of history and make better choices. She thinks at its worst, it could be that we're like some kind of rat or mouse in a wheel going round and round and round with the same stick whacking us on the back of the head every time it comes round. But she says, this isn't true. She says, look at history. It's got plenty of examples where we actually do learn from the lessons of history and make better choices. The second test that she tries out is, well, maybe there are just a few bad apples. A few people who, at the critical moment, make a really bad decision, and they're the one that bring everybody into this terrible situation. And in fact, this was a thesis which the French, to go back to them, tried to apply during their revolution. Robespierre, in particular, believed that it would be possible to create a republic of virtue, and they specifically named it as that, if only they cut off the heads of all the bad apples. You know, enough heads go, and you've got what's left is a perfect barrel, and it's a republic of virtue. It turned out not to be a particularly great idea, which he found out himself as he lost his head towards the end of the terror. But there's that theory. But Barbara Tuchman actually comes back and says, no, this is not, in any of these cases, just simply a few bad apples who are participating in this bad decision-making. In fact, it's a whole distributed network of people in leadership positions and others who all contribute to these very bad decisions. And eventually, she comes and she says, well, look, there is one thing that comes up time and time and time again to explain how these bad decisions are made. And what it turns out to be is what she describes as wooden-headedness, or which I would translate, because I think it's easier to understand, it is the way in which we are held in thrall by unthinking custom and practice. When you go back to the people I mentioned before, those who have collaborated or colluded in wrongdoing, they will truthfully tell you that they didn't see it at the time. When you ask them to explain to you why they did not see it, how did they become complicit? Then their answer is, well, everyone was doing it. That was just the way things were done. In other words, if you are in a situation like those people in the photograph, or some of the people that have been involved in other atrocities at time, or where you are suddenly drawn into a situation where you find yourself somehow or other becoming complicit, it does not necessarily mean that this has happened to you because you are a bad person. You may be a perfectly good person who is making a bad decision, not seeing it as such, because that's just what everybody does, because that's just the way things are done around here. And I would like to have a dollar for every time I've gone into an organisation or an institution where there's been ethical failure and had that conversation and heard that. And even to this day, I can tell you that there are many, many places where you will walk in the door and ask people to explain to you why they are doing what they are doing, and you will still today get no better explanation than it's just what we do, or everybody does it. That's how the insurance industry works, or banking, or sport. Everybody does it, and so on and so forth. And it might be, at this point in time, a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But who knows when eventually you step over the line and it becomes something subject to condemnation. So that's how it's possible to become a collaborator. Even a collaborator in something which is wrong, without you necessarily feeling that you are deliberately or willfully doing so, but because you don't see it.
It's such vital terrain that Dr. Simon Longstaff is exploring today. We're looking at the dark side of collaboration. And he is a philosopher, he is director of the Ethics Centre, and he is today's big thinker on Big Ideas. You're on ABC Radio National, and you can find us, Big Ideas, on the ABC Listen app. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Simon is speaking at the Bundanon Art Museum in regional New South Wales. And up next, tribalism, cancel culture, social media. How do we find our way through that whole maze?
Well, where are we today in all of this? Well, I think we're in a time when the ability for people to look at their world and to see it for what it actually is becoming more and more constrained, in part by the degree of uncertainty in our world at the moment, and the need to find some place where we can belong, our tribe, if you like. But the trouble is that in the world of social media as it's evolved, and particularly in a censorious world, which requires a kind of brittle, crystalline purity of belief on almost any question, we have very much lost our ability to engage with ambiguity, to recognise that there can be moments of principled disagreement, that people of goodwill can and do disagree without being bad people. So in social media, one of the interesting transitions that's taken place, which has been observed over some years now, is that it used to be that when people would have a disagreement about something, they would put forward their ideas and the conclusion would be, well, I don't think you are right. You are mistaken. You have an error of judgment. What has happened, though, in the last few years is a difference of opinion has transmuted into being a form of judgment that you are, in fact, a bad person. people are now being told that because they do not agree with another person, that that is not because they are mistaken or have a different worldview, but because they are a bad person. And because they are considered to be bad, they are also subject to shunning. If you like, a digital version of what happened to those women in the pictures that we saw at the beginning of this speech. And not only that is happening, but additionally, there is an everyday escalation taking place in the conditions for belonging to the tribe. So you might enter into your tribal group, find your people, start to share ideas, and it might be a reasonably open and modest set of expectations for what you need to do to affirm your rightness, that is, your fittingness to belong to this group. It goes a bit further then, and somebody says something which is a little bit out of the mainstream view, and people say, ah, they don't really belong here. They're a bad person. They're shunned. And not only that, but then there becomes an expectation on everybody who remains that they must amp up, increase, strengthen the evidence of the level of their commitment. And so you're pushed to affirm a slightly more extreme view which accords with the new norm that's been established following the other person being shunned. And so these areas start to become increasingly intense in their expectations, increasingly exclusive in those who can join or not join, and have an increasing tendency to excommunicate, to purge those who don't accord with their views. Now, we have seen this operating not just within the world of social media, but we've also seen it in what was for a period called cancel culture, where people are saying that voice should not be heard. It's given rise to some very important, interesting debates about accountability, because you ask, is it possible that a person should be accountable for what they say? Yes. No one should say anything without being held to account for the views they express. But does accountability in this world mean that you should shun, exclude, and remove all traces of their views from the select community to which you belong? Or are you, in this sense, starting to collude, to collaborate in a form of wrongdoing which denies some of the most important elements that we need to draw upon as a society in order to have a vibrant community? I think here about the role of the arts, for example. We were talking last night about art both as a mirror to our society and as a shattering of the mirror that we reflect. How much room are we going to leave for artists to express views which are contrary to a dominant narrative? We've seen it recently with the Venice Biennale and the exclusion of some artists for holding views expressed in their artworks which are inconsistent with a particular view of how the world ought to be. Is that what we want to do to art? Is it supposed to be conforming, or is there room for a divergence of opinion that art has always offered? What of the people in any debate that is breaking our society at the moment, where we feel the fracture lines coming? Are we required to adhere to this notion of crystalline ideological purity so no one can question what one group or another is doing without being seen as having betrayed that ideal or being an enemy of their perspective? Or can we ask questions? And I think here, in a way which is very obvious, about the debate about what's taking place in the Middle East at the moment or in the war between Russia and Ukraine, can a Jewish person question the government of Benjamin Netanyahu? Can a Palestinian question the legitimacy of Hamas and its acts? Can any of us engage in that debate without having to pick a side and set aside any kind of notion of nuance? What happens to the person that wants to invoke a universal sense of human rights, that irrespective of one's flag or one's religion, every person should be accorded that fundamental and intrinsic dignity and protected from the excesses that can come when tribal animosity is let loose, when hate is at loose in the world? So there are some things that we can do in relation to this world that we're living in and the challenges we face around this darker side of collaboration. And here I'm talking about that side of collaboration, not its sunny side, which allows us to cooperate and build beautiful and useful things, but the kind of thing which where collaboration starts to shut us down, to close us out, to demand our commitment and our belonging to an extent where we no longer even see where we are going and the ethical significance of what it is that we do. What does the antidote look like? Well, it's a particular faculty which at the Ethics Centre we call constructive subversion. It's the idea that we should, all of us should, engage in the act of subverting unthinking custom and practice. No one should ever accept that the reason why something is done or not done is simply because everyone does it, or because that's just the way we do things around here. Our task, if we're willing to take it up, is to subvert that view by demanding that things be explained by reference to a set of core values and principles that explain why this thing is good or right. And we don't do this in order to pull things down, to destroy, to wreck. We should do this in the constructive spirit in which I hope we can take it up, because this is how you build something so that it is true to the ideals it claims for itself. So that does require us to demand of our organisations and our institutions that they tell us, who are you? What do you stand for? What are the values and the principles that you will use as the standard for judgment? And then, having declared that, let us also play a role in ensuring that what you say you are going to do is what you actually do. And when we find an example of conduct which is inconsistent with what you claim, then in a spirit of constructive subversion, if you like, in a spirit of curiosity, we'll point this out to you so that you can correct that, so that you don't progressively slip away from the ideal that you yourself has proclaimed. But to do this, I can tell you, for everyone in this room and everyone listening to this, does require what is often held to be the highest virtue of all, and that is moral courage. Because we live in a world in which almost no one will thank you for doing this. Most people, most of the time, do not want to be troubled with a question like, why are we doing this? Most people, most of the time, would not like to be told that there's an incongruity between what they say they value and their principles and what they actually do. Most people would prefer you to stay quiet, not to raise your voice, not to make their life more difficult. And so one has to think about how to exercise moral courage in this way, which is actually not only constructive for the organisation, but also preserving of your own well-being. So I know sometimes when people hear me talk about this idea, they think, oh, I know what you have in mind. You should think we should all go and throw ourselves on the funeral pyre of integrity, you know, big blaze and lots of beautiful sparks and we're gone and then there's a few pile of ashes and that's it. I'm not saying that. I'm not talking about a kind of recklessness here. I'm talking about a measured, thoughtful, creative, even agile approach. But it does require courage. And this is going to bring me, and I'll start to close on this, to some ideas about collaboration and things like courage as informed by Aristotle's notion of the golden mean. Because I did mention Aristotle earlier on, and I thought that he had something interesting to say in all of this. Those of you who know of Aristotle's work will know that he was very interested in what we see and what we don't see. And I mentioned this has been a big issue in philosophy for a long time. And I'm not here just talking about whether the world we observe or perceive is actually as it is. And I'm not talking about the kind of radical scepticism of someone like Descartes. What I'm trying to point to is this Aristotelian view that virtue enables us to see the world as it is. And I'll give you an example. It's a kind of a silly one, but you'll get it. So if Aristotle was to do an experiment with us today, he'd come along and he'd say, look, I've got a 1 meter long ruler here. Everyone in the room, I'm going to get you to put your hand out and without warning, I'll drop the meter ruler and you've got to try and grab it as fast as you can. And I'll measure where it is on the ruler that your hand clasps it. And that will give me what is both objective measurement of your reaction speed, but also a relative measure of your speed compared to everyone else, because some of them will overlap, but typically they'll be just a little bit different depending on who you are and age and a whole lot of things. Part two of Aristotle's test, he says, let's go now out to the kitchen or the bar and you'll find there a series of shot glasses with alcohol. They are identical in quantity and quality. And your job now is to have as much of this alcohol as you'd like in order to reduce your reaction speed by half. He says, there's going to be both an objective amount of alcohol that has that effect on you, and it will be relative to your body mass, age, how tired you are, things like that. And he says that the person who possesses the vice of gluttony will not be able to make that evaluation. They won't see the world clearly enough to do that. They'll have far more than they're going to actually need, because that's what the glutton is impelled to do. And so what Aristotle claims is that we need to develop a faculty called phronesis, old Greek word which simply means practical wisdom. And its great utility, and it comes aligned with virtue, is that we see the world as it is. And so comes the golden mean. He says, if you want to understand what courage is, it's not the recklessness that sees you run into the face of the cannon and be massacred without any good effect, nor is it hiding behind all of your friends where you are completely free from any risk of harm. He says courage sits in between those two things. It's about truly appreciating, understanding the nature of the danger before you, but nonetheless standing there. Collaboration, what could it be? Well, on one end of the spectrum might be conformity and complicity in a worldview or in a particular approach. Or at the other end, it could be a kind of atomization. Nietzsche's Übermensch, if you like, someone who doesn't need to belong to anything, that doesn't regard with any favour the herd, who sees themselves as constantly evaluating and revaluing in their own individual pursuit. Neither of those, I think, would meet Aristotle's test of the golden mean. Rather, collaboration is something which is about understanding the risks of conditioned blindness under the conditions I've described, but nonetheless resisting the temptation to recede into isolation or atomization, but still seeing what could be done together in order to bring about a good result. And so what are some of the key questions, and I'll finish on this, that we might ask for ourselves when trying to evaluate, is this something where we should collaborate? Is this the light side rather than the dark side? First, what are the underlying values, principles and goals of the collaboration? Are they aligned with principles of things like justice, dignity, respect for all individuals? Am I fully informed about the potential consequences of this collaboration? Have I considered the perspectives of those who might be negatively affected? You see how the scope of our vision is increasing. Am I collaborating out of genuine conviction, or am I succumbing to external pressures or fear of retribution? Have I critically examined the actions and motivations of my fellow collaborators? Are they acting ethically, transparently? Have they made the same kind of process I'm looking at here? Am I open to dissenting opinions? Am I willing to engage in constructive dialogue with those who might disagree, rather than just shutting them out? And finally, am I prepared to take responsibility for the outcomes of this collaboration, both positive and negative? And with those questions in mind, I think that's where I will end and throw it open to questions.
Just in the example of the Aristotelian golden mean, I was reflecting on one of those types of blindness is about authority, and you gave the example of the Milgram experiment,
yes,
which is excessive reliance on authority. But to some extent, it seems like we have the opposite problem as well, where climate change is a good example, where there is an authority that perhaps we should respect. That is expert opinion, and that's increasingly questioned as well. So do we have a problem there on both sides of authority?
We do, but I think the cause of that problem is more general, to do with the loss of trust in institutions. And I could give a whole talk about what I call the long age of forgetting and how institutions have ultimately forgotten and therefore betrayed their purpose. And this has gone on not just with a few isolated cases, but has permeated the whole of society. And so that loss of trust, I think, is the core problem that needs to be restored. And you can only do that when you do two of the things I talked about, which is firstly, declare the basis on which you're prepared to be judged, that is, make clear the values and principles, and then consistently act in a manner which is aligned to those, not just in relation to one or two people, which is often what you'll see happen, but across the full spectrum of your relationships. Because if you don't treat everybody in a manner which is consistent with the standard judgment you yourself claim, then you'll never rebuild trust. And I think if we could turn our mind as a society to that as a real project to make our institutions trustworthy, then many of the problems about discounting things like science and evidence would be addressed.
Hi there, Simon. My question is, the idea of constructive subversion is sounds very exciting in terms of potential. The question I would always have in the idea of that moral courage that's required is what form it might take in a world where there's so many platforms that are controlled by plutocrats, that where global capitalism is controlling so many, if you think of newspapers, online digital things. Of course, there's the everyday, but it's often a question that comes up is what form it might be when the public debate is so, it's a concept that we are dominated by social media, may or may not be true, but it's a question about form of where that constructive subversion might take place in the public space.
So the first thing about it is getting yourself into the space where you're comfortable to do anything rather than to stay in a state of conformity or subjugation or whatever it happens to be, however you describe it. The good news is that the world changes in many ways that don't require grand acts of heroism. In fact, we, of course, celebrate the Mandelas and the Gandhis and others in the world. But actually, a lot of change comes about when individuals just fall on the right side of a question. And if enough people do that, just little gestures, just on the right side of the question, then collectively that can change the world. And one of the things that we struggle with most is not our powerlessness, but our belief that we are powerless. And so I would say you need to look at the scope of conduct in which you might engage in acts of constructive subversion. Of course, you never have to do it alone. Sometimes perhaps you do, but oftentimes you'll have allies, other people of a like mind who can do just a little bit too, which helps to tilt the world on its axis. And there may even be people who are very powerful who discover, perhaps to their surprise, that it's in their self-interest to recognise what you say and to change. So I don't think there is a single form. I think there are multiple forms like there are in life. They're contingent upon your circumstances. But instead of being passive in the face of those, some of these things you make by the communities you form, the alliances you establish, and sometimes even by the way you reframe the world in ways that open opportunities that otherwise are not apparent to anyone else. And that's unfortunately given the time where I have to end. So thanks so much, everyone, for coming along.
Questions for our times, right? And questions to ask ourselves. Thank you so much to philosopher Dr. Simon Longstaff there, director of the Ethics Centre. He was speaking at the Bundanon Art Museum, once home to the couple artist Arthur Boyd and artist turned art patron and philanthropist Yvonne Boyd. And gifted by them to the Australian people. Ethics in action right there, don't you think? My name is Natasha Mitchell. Back next time with more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.